Guido Wimmers is a passive house expert with many buildings to his credit in his native Austria. He came to British Columbia partly to oversee the construction of a model building called Austria House for the 2010 Winter Olympic Games. Austria House barely sips energy, even in the cold winter climate of Whistler, the famous ski resort. It is now Canada's foremost example of super energy efficiency. Dr. Wimmers delivered his workshop at the Lighthouse Sustainable Building Center in Vancouver on March 20, 2010. This is part one of two, as recorded by Alex Smith of CFRO Radio.
To introduce Guido briefly, he's focused his work on energy-efficient architecture over the last 10 years, specializing in building physics and passive house technology. So he's originally an architect, did his PhD at the University of Innsbruck, Faculty of Engineering, and then he's since worked as a consultant and architect designing and building low-energy and passive houses in Austria, Germany, and Italy. So he's going to be discussing today the passive house in general and present the first passive house in BC, which is the Austria House in Whistler. And the building has hosted the Austrian team during the Olympics and will later serve as the mountain bike club and cross-country ski club. So it's an exciting building, and thank you for joining us. So.
Thanks. Well, that's quite an audience here. Nice. Thank you for coming. Just a few questions, because I like to know who you are and what your interests are. So first of all, who knows about Passive House? Has anybody of you heard before about Passive House?
I heard about it on the television.
Almost half of that. So, because initially we said, okay, I will talk about this a little bit about Passive House in general, but more about the house in Whistler. So what I have not done is showing you all the requirements and everything like that, because I thought that most of you already know that. That was maybe a mistake, but we can do that verbally, no problem. Which of you is in the building industry, like builder, architects, and, well, it's, again, roughly half of you. And are there some clients who are actually want to build a passive house for them, or? Okay. Right, that's interesting. Good mixture. But before we start with passive house, to get a little bit closer into that topic, we just want to. Can you see that? Is that okay? So the first thing is just to make clear, what are we actually talking about? We're talking basically about energy consumption and a lot of other things which are directly or indirectly related to energy consumption. When we take a look in human history, what humans did over the last few thousand years, we can clearly say everything was based on solar energy, because we used biomass. We burned wood. Without the sun, no wood, no trees, no nothing. So biomass is clearly related to the sun. The same with hydropower, the same with wind power. Everything is indirectly driven by the sun. So up to 1800-something, our whole society, all humans were using solar energy directly or indirectly. Then 1800-something, it started with coal, later on with oil, and a little bit later with gas. So that's what we do right now. We use quite a bit of fossil energy. And actually, it's a pretty moot point to discuss where exactly we are on that curve. I think it's just pretty clear we are somewhere at the top. So a colleague of mine called that one the fossil fart. It's just a very short period in human history. And everything else in the future very likely will be, again, based on solar energy. Very likely. We haven't come up with smart other solutions. Yeah, nuclear power is maybe a solution. I don't know. But everything else, what we're discussing these days, renewable energy, is, again, only based on solar. It's solar thermal, it's photovoltaic, it's biomass. Is wind power, is water, so hydropower. So everything will be very likely, again, based on solar energy. Especially here in Vancouver, we are very, very green, and we're proud of that. But on the other side, let's face it, let's take a look, where are we exactly? And these data are not based on Vancouver, they're not based on BC, it's Canadian average. Because it's a global issue, so it doesn't make sense to stop some data just at the border of your city, or even of your problems. So we should look at that at least in a kind of a national base. This graph shows you watts per capita, so how much energy do we consume. It's not kilowatt hours, it's just watt. And the world is probably able to supply the planet with about 2,000 watts. This is the red line. If you can see, the average here in Europe, in quite a few European states, is roughly around the 5,000 kilowatt. Watt. Here in Canada, we use about 12,000. So that's just way more than theoretically is allowed to have kind of a sustainable system on our planet. There are just a very few nations who actually use more energy than we do. I mean, even the US is better on average. So, United Arab Emirates, it's really pretty clear. Even Kuwait is slightly better in terms of energy efficiency than we are. So this should be kind of an eye-opener to start to think about what we're actually doing. So energy, very, very strong related, is CO2, so carbon, carbon emissions. And again, we can see that Canada is not really in a very good situation. If you compare to what we should have done regarding the Kyoto Protocol, the goal was to minimize the carbon emissions by 6%, to lower them by 6%. What we actually did was they increased over 30%. So we can discuss about if Kyoto Treaty was extremely good or not that good or whatever, but it's just the big picture. Well, we are moving into the wrong direction still.
That's our global figure? Global or Canada?
That's just Canada. Just Canada. So for Canada, the goal was -6, and we're actually over 30% plus. Other sources come up with other numbers. This is, for example, the Green Canada, Canada's Green Building Council. They say, okay, 33%. From the Kyoto target. At the end, it doesn't matter. Are we talking about 30, 33 or whatever? It's pretty clear that we're definitely going in the wrong direction. We should be here, but we are there. Why is that the case? I mean, this one, for example, shows you how people in our society think these days. Basically, it is easy to market something as very green because 36 miles per gallon, wow, that's great. Well, it's not. It's still 36, not the other way around, so it's quite a few gallons too much. This is not how we can go into the direction green. So this is just kind of a delusion of what we're doing there. And it's really getting worse. That's the best example I've found so far. So that is the green car of the year in 08. Hello, wake up. This is not green. You can put a small hybrid motor in that. Yeah, fine. But there are some fundamental misunderstandings, I think. That's simply not working. So we cannot go on like this. What we actually have done over the last 50 years was something like that. So this is about the evolution. I think we have to work on that. It wasn't always like that. The oldest passive house example I've found so far, or actually I haven't found it, a colleague of mine in Germany found this one. there was a Norwegian guy, he sailed to the North Pole in 1893. And what he did with his ship is quite amazing. So he's had 40 centimeter of insulation. I don't know exactly technically how he did it. He has had triple pane glass, so triple pane windows. Don't ask me about the technical stuff, what he has really done there or how he has achieved that. But I think the major message was, and you can read that in his kind of diary, he was thinking about throwing out the album because it was just simply taking up room. He didn't use it. And that was at the North Pole in 1893. And it was a mobile thing. It was not even a house. It was not a building. It was a ship. So quite amazing what happened there. Another thing which quite a few people have forgotten about. I don't know. Has somebody of you seen that picture before? That's in Saskatchewan. The so-called Saskatchewan Conservation House, 1977. this was actually, so to say, the first pacifist. Because from there, the movement more or less started. I don't know what happened here in Canada in between. Yeah, some people found some tar sand or something in that direction. But this was quite amazing. So these fellows have had the first nearly airtight building, triple glazed windows, R40 insulation for the walls, R60 for the roof. So quite amazing for these days. And it was not the only building. There are quite a few more in that region. So in Saskatoon, for example, in the late 80s, another fellow has built something very similar to that. So there was something going on, but since then, not much more followed.
Sorry, I have a question.
Yeah.
Passive house, that generally refers to a house that is energy neutral?
Well, there's a clear definition for passive house, so there are requirements in terms of energy consumption. The old approach, so basically the idea is that these buildings actually work almost passively. So you design something in terms of orientation, architecture, building components, and envelope quality, which can work more or less on its own. So you don't need a cooling system in summer, and you almost don't need a heating system in winter. It's not zero, it's not net zero. So you still need some energy, but it's almost passively working. Maybe I can show a few other slides later on, give you a clear definition, but there are some requirements, for example, 15 kilowatt-hours per square meter. That's the maximum heat demand of these buildings, for example. There are requirements for airtightness, for heat bridges, and all that stuff. But coming back to this here, so what the guys in Saskatoon, or Saskatchewan, in Regina, what they did there, 1977, so that's quite a while ago, few other people were inspired by that, and for example, one was a German, and he picked up the idea of it, and just what he did was more or less he just suggested a few further specifications, and he started with a German word, to simply Passivhaus. The first one were clearly residential. That's the very first one is a fourplex, built 1991 in Darmstadt, close to Frankfurt in Germany. But Passivhaus should not be translated word by word with passive house directly, because we're talking about passive building and not passive house. So house does not mean that we're limited to small residential. Most of them are, true, but we have designed schools and office buildings and everything with it, so it works with other building types as well. Coming back to Canada, where are we right now? These are some data from 06, so sorry, it's not really the new states, but it hasn't changed that much. Certainly not in terms of percentage. So that is the energy Canadians average use for their space heating system. Right now it's just space heating. 55% is natural gas. Natural gas is a nice, very nice word. Sounds really organic. But it's still fossil energy. So maybe, yeah, it's the best from the fossil energies, but it's still fossil energy, so it's far away from good. That's 55%. Another 11% heating oil, and if you sum them up together, you end up with 66%, so two-thirds. Actually, in reality, it's more than that, because the 19% of electricity are harvested by fossil energy. Quite a bit of that. So a big portion of that includes fossil energy as well. So at the end, realistically, we come up with almost three-quarters of the energy we use today is fossil energy to heat Canadian households. A few other numbers I found, the total amounts of energy we use and the total floor space we heat in Canada. And when we divide these numbers, we come up with 150 kilowatt hours per square meter. So this is what Canadians use to heat up their houses in average, statistic average. If we add the other, so that's the red portion, the 150. If we add the other parts in addition, so the hot water, the electric power for auxiliary systems like venting, like pumps, and the electric power for lights and plug loads and so on, you come up into an area for residential buildings, which is around 240 kilowatt hours. That's roughly what we can consume. New buildings, modern buildings, are better, no question they are. But actually not that much. The passive house, what I'm referring to, you can see just simply from the graphic, that is a major step. And the passive house, for example, has the limit in terms of heating energy, 15 kilowatt hours, versus the Canadian average of 150. So it's just a tenth. And also the other systems have to be way more energy efficient, because for the plug loads, you're just allowed to have 18 kilowatt hours. So in total, we're talking about 33 versus 240 in average. So it is a major step, but it's not rocket science. It's actually relatively easy to achieve.
How does that compare to Europe? Canada's 240. You know, off the top of your head, where would you somewhere less than 240?
Pardon me?
Somewhere less than 240 would be a European average?
Yeah, slightly. It is less.
Maybe 200?
Yes, like I think it's, I just have the numbers from Germany in my head, and I think it's about 180, something like that, in that area. So it's also an average building in Germany is not a passive house. So we have roughly 20,000 units built in Europe. That's great, that's good. But still, if you compare it to the total amount of buildings, that's just a small portion. But at least it's way more than LEED buildings, everyone knows. So this one here, again, another source, but it comes up with pretty much the same data. And this one is based on commercial buildings. So for commercial buildings, the average is somewhere at 380. The residential were 240, commercials at 380. But still, you can build a commercial as a passive house as well. And these data are here from BC. So the average in BC was at 350 roughly for commercial buildings. The most scary part is that unfortunately the energy intensity is still growing every year. Every year, so we're not actually that green. Every year we use 2.5% more energy for our households and for our commercial buildings and for all the buildings we have in BC. So yeah, the newest buildings we build are slightly better than the old ones, but in total we are still increasing our energy loads year by year.
Does that 2.5% growth reflect growth in the number of buildings?
It does. We build new stuff. They're slightly better in energy consumption, but they still add up to a total. That's very true. And we cannot keep up in terms of renovation the older ones just to balance it. That's what we at least should do. But we cannot, or we haven't done it yet. We can, I think we could, but we haven't done that. These numbers are just for the commercial, but they're very similar for the average of the 2.5% is very equal for residential buildings as well. It was 2.4 or something like that. So it's basically the same dimension, so it's still growing. And main reason, yeah, for sure, because every year we build a few more houses and we forget about to renovate the old ones just to balance the overall energy consumption. And yeah, there are more people living here. True. The city's growing. But still, there are some limits, so we have to handle our energy consumption in total. Because I think, yeah, we could easily, the city could easily grow, or Lower Mainland could easily grow for another million people, and it will over the next 10, 15 years, for sure. But we cannot go on with energy intensity year by year by year, just increases by population, so we have to limit that in some way. This is a quote I found in the LEED guide, and it's based on a few different research or studies. And what it says basically is that 85% of the environmental impact of our buildings is caused by its energy consumption over its lifetime. That's very important, because that means we should not forget about the materials with how we build our buildings, about embodied energy. That's important, yes. But the major impact is how much energy they consume over the next 50 years. That is the major impact. So it makes absolutely sense to choose green materials if you build or renovate something. No question about that. But still, the major impact is how much does the building consume over the next 20, 30, 40, 50 years, or whatever. So over its lifetime. And lifetime could be actually a little bit longer than most people assume. I've heard that quite often here in the city. Yeah, but we just built for 30 years. Our buildings are they should just last 30 years. Well, first of all, that's maybe not that sustainable. And second of all, it's true, the buildings are built just for 30 years, but they're still standing here even if they're 100 years old, which means they're falling apart. The most common roof decking here is a white tarp in the city, because we have all these leaky condos. They are not built to last longer than the 30 years. They're true. But we shouldn't do it like that, because we keep the buildings way longer than the 30 years. So this is something we always have to keep in mind, that actually the energy consumption of our households, of our buildings, doesn't matter if we talk about commercial or residential. At the end, it comes down to the same. The major impact is the energy consumption on a daily basis. How much do we use for lights, for heating, and all that stuff? That has the biggest influence on the environment. To come down more, a little bit more into the direction of what passive actually means. Passive means we should use the sun more. We should not just try to keep it out. Well, we have to keep it out if we have problems with overheating in summer, too. Well, we can use it in the winter time, very good. And the sun is delivering us quite a bit of energy, so I don't know if somebody of you guys knows the name of that number, but it's a lot. And it's about 10,000 times more than we actually need, humans on this planet. So it's way more than we need. The only thing what we have to do is to figure out how to deal with it. That energy comes more or less for free, because we don't have to pay per kilowatt hour. We have to pay for the system, which just transfers that power from the sun into electricity or whatever, or just simply into heat. So this one we have to invest in. But from there on, the source itself is absolutely free.
True, that is a very big number, and true, it's about 10,000 times larger than what we need. But when it comes to converting, you know, the inefficiency of converting that into usable energy, how much of that is accessible to us?
But that's exactly the point. I think just human mankind is not smart enough until now to figure out how to deal with that in a very efficient way. So we have photovoltaic, right? What is the efficiency of photovoltaic at the end? 25%, something like that. But first we have to subtract what happens in the higher atmosphere in terms of reflection and so on. I totally agree. But still, it is far more. So it's still, we have reaching the surface of the Earth itself is the 10,000 times more. So we just have to figure out how to deal with that. And I think we were just not smart enough with it. But now, you're going already, actually there are two different possibilities. One thing is saving energy and the other one is generating energy. And what I try to point out is, first of all, I think it's smart to think about how to save energy, because that's always cheaper than generating energy. And I don't know if somebody of you guys was here last week with the Net Zero talk. It's going in the same direction. So to save energy is relatively cheap. I have to have more insulation and a little bit better windows and that stuff. So for a building, this is, I don't know, we're talking about in terms of investment. Yeah, that hurts quite a bit of money, but you have a payback. And you have a payback in several different ways. It's not just money-wise. It's also healthy living and very comfortable and all that. With energy generating systems, it's getting tricky, because these days they are still too expensive because of a lack of efficiency. Maybe that changes over the next 10, 20 years. We don't know yet. But how to save energy and make the house at least 90% more efficient? This technology exists. We can do that right away. I want to tell you a little bit about the story of the Austria house. So, a small group, so I was part of that. We came about 4 years ago, first time to Vancouver. That was my very first visit in Canada. I've never been there before. And we have had the idea that for the Olympic Games, we could contribute, because in Europe, they were promoted like the first green Olympics ever. That was the big slogan of Vancouver 4 years ago. And we thought, okay, Austria can contribute. We have a good idea what to do. Every big winter sport nation, and Austria is a big winter sport nation. Okay, it's a tiny nation. It fits 26 times into BC. But in terms of winter sports, even if they haven't been very successful this time. But yeah, let's assume still it's a big winter sport nation. So we spoke to a guy from BC government who was traveling in Europe, and his job was to organize know-how transfer, find new ideas, find new people who want to team up with Canadian companies and so on. And we came in touch with him, so we decided, yeah, okay, let's go to Whistler in Vancouver and take a look at it. and maybe we can convince both Whistler and the Austrian Olympic Committee to build a passive house as the national pavilion for the games. So we've had a blast there, you can tell.
And finally,
and this was here, a few of you will maybe know, so this is the entrance door to the old lighthouse. You guys moved here, I don't know, a year ago? Or even less, something like that? Before that, you were based on Granite Island, and that was the entry door. So I came in touch with Lighthouse 4 years ago. The gentleman on the right side, he is the official, he's the architect of the Austrian Pavilion. The other two guys are owners of different companies in Austria. Unfortunately, here, this guy, Paulus, a good friend of mine, he died last year, was hit by a rock on the Matterhorn, and it was over. So he couldn't enjoy the Austrian Pavilion at all, which is really a pity. And quite a few more people were involved to start a project like that. This gentleman, Matteo Durfeld, was the general contractor in Whistler, so we had to include local companies in the question. Because of sponsorship and so on, we had to pre-manufacture everything in Europe. And by the way, pretty much every passive house is prefab. You don't build them on site because you cannot achieve the quality and the accuracy on site. You have to go with prefab anyway. And it's kind of funny because when we talk about prefab, the argument what I hear here is very often, oh, we cannot afford it. It's just too expensive. You hear the same argument in Europe, vice versa. We cannot afford to build on site. It's just too expensive. I don't know. I haven't made up my mind, so it's kind of funny to hear for so totally different opinion. But however, yeah, so at the end, the whole building was shipped, 9 containers, including everything. That has something to do with sponsorship, because all major sponsors were Austrian and German companies. And sure, if one of these companies comes, for example, for the sheeting materials and says, hey, you can have my sheeting material, we say, yeah, great, thank you, and put it into the container. So it was kind of a funny story. In between, it was, quite frankly, a little bit annoying, too, because it was like a flea circuit to handle all that. Some colleagues, especially in Austria, they have had a lot of work with that. But now I will show you just a few photos and just a little bit about the history, how the whole thing was built. That was the site pretty much at the beginning. And you can see here, we digged about less than 2 meter, it was 1.8 meter depth or something like that, into the ground, and laid down these slopes, or slopes with kind of, that is the kind of a heat exchanger. And it's not under the building, it is in front of the building, because the idea is that in this area you store, so to say, indirectly, the energy of the sun. So during the summer, the whole thermal mass of that area will be heated up, so in winter you can suck out, so to say, the energy out of the ground. The major idea the necessity to do that was simply the building had to work under very extreme conditions over the 6 or 7, 8 weeks now during the Olympic Games and Paralympic Games. So it was hard to estimate how many people were there. There will be tremendous high peak loads when up to 200 people are in that building. You have to cool. Even in the cold winter, you have to do something. So that was kind of a backup system, especially for the 8 or 6, 8 weeks of the games itself. We would not, or we don't have to use something like that afterwards. It's there, so as a backup, great to have it, but it was not necessary for the kind of ordinary use after the games.
Is that geothermal storage?
Well, it's kind of geothermal, yeah. It's just not drilling deep, it's just very near to the surface, but it is kind of geothermal.
It's done laterally like that here as well.
Pardon me?
It's done laterally as opposed to vertically here as well.
Yeah, well, this was done by a local company here. So
you heat the earth up and then in summer and reverse the cycle and take it out in winter.
Exactly. Very simple, straightforward system. So the next thing was, the material you can see there is the insulation. So it's HPS basically, so extruded polystyrene. The material itself might be not that green, but still it gives you a very good insulation value, and then you can put the concrete on top of that. So what you do is you have something with, I think you call it raft slab. So just one concrete layer for the foundation. The next level was, okay, because it was a little bit slope there, so we had to build the concrete wall in the back and you make everything completely watertight. And there you can already see the concrete walls. And then, so this is the insulation we have seen before. This is now the concrete wall. This is done with just typical, what is that? You call it peel and stick? Yeah. So these are all Canadian materials. And then you bring the insulation on top of that. So this is the insulation layer. Insulation layer there was 20 centimeter. And then you have a few penetrations for cable, for water, and for sewage. And afterwards, you have this kind of, it's like a fleece, geotextile, or whatever you want to call that. And then just with rubble, you fill it. So this was the moment when, so up to that point, it was done completely by local companies in Whistler. They started, I think, in June, and they were done July, end of July, something like that. So, but from here on, the Austrian companies took over, and then the containers came and they started with the wood construction. So first they put up the structural system. Then, as you can see here, solid wood floors. So I don't know if you can clearly see that, but this is cross-laminated wood here. So you have five layers crosswise to each other, and they're glued to each other. So you get, instead of having 20 centimeters of concrete, you have 20 centimeters of solid wood. You use that as a floor. Quite a few people ask, well, that's a lot of wood. True. But I think it's better than a lot of concrete. Because wood is the only renewable building material we have. Wood is regrowing. Precondition is that you don't have any clear cuts. It has to be kind of a harvest or sustainable or environmentally responsible harvested wood. If so, it's a great material because it's regrowing every day. So it's funny to see that Europeans have a different approach to wood. They actually want to use more wood instead of less. Here in North America, I figured out that people are concerned about using too much wood and just want to save wood and want to make the structure as light as possible.
I'm slightly confused. The heat that the building gains, concrete's a lot better use of the thermal mass than wood. So why do you use wood over concrete on that basis? I know you've got renewable issues, but
thermal mass is up to a certain level is important, yes. But from my perspective, it's widely overestimated. But that's just one issue. The other issue is that the specific heat capacity of wood is actually pretty high. If you compare that with concrete by mass, by kilogram, 1 kilogram of concrete, 1 kilogram of wood has actually double the thermal mass than concrete has. So it's kind of unfair because we don't compare the kilogram. Concrete is way, way heavier than wood. So theoretically, you should compare it by volume. And then it's just half of it. True. But still, it's a significant contribution to thermal mass, not comparable with stud walls. If you go with solid wood elements, it's way more mass than stud walls. And for buildings like these, it's absolutely sufficient. We have already the concrete slab, and this is included in your thermal mass of the building because the insulation is underneath. And then in addition, you have some concrete walls. So theoretically, it's already sufficient thermal mass there. But then on top you also add this one, so it's just another benefit, but it's perfect in terms of noise reduction. It is, even in terms of fire, it's a pretty good material. And it is environmentally friendly because it's renewable, it's growing.
Could you use bamboo?
You could use bamboo, yeah, you could. I'm a little bit scared about bamboo because, most of that is harvested in this kind of plantations, monocultures. Actually, they're also not very good for the region. Wood is very slow growing, so precondition is always that you don't go with clear cut and just, destroy. If you don't do that, wood is actually very sustainable because it is a long term in between. If you replant and harvest, I don't know how much it is, but I would estimate at least 50 years in between. So it's not twice a year, which really humidity is almost your soil.
Ah, so it depletes the soil, that's why it's...
Yeah.
But you're storing carbon.
You do. And that's what you don't want about carbon. That's very true.
Yeah.
Yeah. So don't get me wrong, I'm not generally against bamboo. I'm just a little bit careful with, okay, how it's really planted and harvested and so on. But theoretically, yeah, you could use bamboo for something like that as well. But for this one, this one has used European wood. Yeah, sure, because it was manufactured in Europe. But mountain pine field wood is perfect. It is perfect.
With regard to concrete versus wood, did anyone do a calculation on the cost of energy that goes into making concrete and the both the thermal output of using concrete, that is to say, to mixing water to get the concrete, and
yeah.
Also...
There are calculations. I don't know everything right out of my head, but concrete in terms of embodied energy, which means, okay, you need that much energy and actually produce that much CO2 and so on. Concrete is relatively bad material. Steel is worth, but concrete is already pretty bad. Wood is almost carbon neutral, and over a long time, because you store the carbon, so over a long time, it contributes to our climate. Because instead of burning the wood or it gets rotten or whatever, it's just stored there for the next, 50, 100 years or whatever. So it slows down the process of setting carbon free. Yeah, then it was a very funny time. So we have had about 3 weeks to put up the building, and it was because the local company was involved, so the general contractor in Whistler, and the crew of the solid wood company came in. Later, some other crews came in. It was just kind of a funny thing because people were coming and going, and this kind of mixture between German and English, and one couldn't understand what the other meant. But it was fun. It was nice. A very good atmosphere there. And perfect weather conditions. So. And as you can see here, so all the walls are prefab. The wall you can see here is also a solid wood system, but different. It's not cross-laminated. You just see parallel, more or less, beams. It's almost like a stamp wall and just adding all the studs together to one solid panel. Roughly 2x4 studs, so 10 centimeter in thickness. Beautiful structure from the inside, so if you have a chance to visit the house over the next summer in Whistler, do so. It's just nice from the inside because that's the finished surface already, so you save additional costs for the gypsum boards and whatever, because you already come with a finished surface. And then on the roof, there was also the same system, and then these are additional rafters or something like that. The thickness of the insulation was, 36 centimeter, so quite a bit of insulation in between. And then the next level, so you can see the next layer, it's just simply 4x1, something like that, so just boards. And on top of these boards, you bring this layer here, which is kind of, it's completely vapor diffusion open, but absolutely watertight. So if you get rain, water, whatever, into that layer because of some damages, or failures or whatever, later on, it's absolutely watertight, so the water would go down and drip into your gutter here. And here you can see how they build up then the venting area. The venting is always relatively thick. That's how we deal with that. So I've seen here venting areas of 2, 3, 4 centimeters, so roughly about an inch. I wouldn't dare to do that because the resistance, just in terms of airflow, the resistance is so high that actually nothing is really happening. So you have to tell the air, please go in here, and later on we would see us on the other side. It's just not working. It has to be thicker than layer to have kind of a free airflow. For a roof like that, it's minimum 6 centimeters. Minimum. That is larger because we have had always the municipality of Worcester in our neck, so they were very nice and friendly in terms of giving us the permits and everything. Because, these systems are fine in terms of European codes, but that does not necessarily mean that you just can put them here and build them. So we've had quite a few different discussions about how to make that work. at the end, the building is totally to Canadian code, but each of you knows, or quite a few of you know, that code is always something, okay, it's a good base to discuss. And from there on, you try to argue, figure out, okay, how do you interpret this point? Okay, I interpret that in a slightly different way. So that's the way it goes. So it was nice to work with the city, or the municipality of Whistler. Just in terms of architecture, the architect has had the idea that the roof and the walls, so pretty much the whole envelope, should be done with the same material. Initially, they wanted to have the wood shingle. So, what is the species?
Cedar.
Yeah, cedar shingle. That was the original idea. Some people were not really positive with that because that would mean that we have to replace the wooden roof after, I don't know, 15 years, something like that. And the people who are supposed to pay for that in 15 years were not really happy. Mm-hmm. So we had to find another material in that. So here we ended up with something like, yeah, it's a cement fiberboard. So something like hardy plank or something similar to that. The color black has not something to do with passive house. It don't have to be black. Quite a few people ask me already, oh, is the color part of the concept? No, it's not. It is just an architectural decision, or in that case, because we wanted to have the same material on the roof, like on the walls, there were not many choices left, so we ended up with the black.
So, as an aside, what is the total expected lifespan of this building?
Technically, in terms of building science, easily 100 years or longer. There's not really a real reason why. Maybe you have to redo some, you know, the sheeting or whatever in 50 years. But generally the building could last for a very long time.
Including the roof.
Including the structural parts and everything of the roof, yeah. Just the outer envelope, you maybe have to replace, I don't know, 50, 60 years, something like that. So then it was time to bring in the windows. And from my point of view, we could have bought pretty much everything here in BC. Just two things were not really available. So one thing was definitely the solid wood, but you don't have to have solid wood for a passive house. It was just a nice approach and an idea of the team. It don't have to be solid wood, so you can go with the stucco as well. But then I totally agree, you have to do something for thermal mass. And the other component, which is simply not available, are high-efficient windows. So these we had to ship in no matter what. Triple pane is preconditioned. You will never ever find a passive house without triple pane. That simply does not exist. Even in a relatively mild climate, and Vancouver is mild climate, so if you would build something here in Vancouver, it has to be triple pane. Which is not bad, because the actual price of triple to double, the price difference is actually not that big. Most people think it is, oh, quite a bit of money, then I have to pay double. No, it's not. The difference is not that big.
So you couldn't find something comparable to what you put in there anywhere here in BC?
Anywhere in North America.
Wow. Well, there's one somewhere that's been done here.
There is one company in Ontario with fiberglass windows. They reach a value which comes kind of close to that. So metric U value of these windows is 0.78. The Ontario company comes to 1.1, which is good. The average here is 2.5. So 1.1 is already good, but you have to be below 0.8 to achieve passive house. And wood windows, and from my perspective, and when I deal with sustainable buildings, sure, I want to have a wood window. I don't want to work with fiberglass. Fiberglass is not that bad, but I think wood is just simply better. I haven't found anything, so if you know something, that's would be great to know, but I think there is no company in North America which comes to this. No. Oh, that's for sure. You can have, I don't know, Lowen and everybody offers you triple glaze. They made a misunderstanding. That's not the tricky part. Triple glaze you can easily buy. But with the performance I'm looking for, it's actually not that easy. But with the framing, it's impossible. You won't find anything in North America right now. That will change over the next year, I'm pretty sure. But these days, there's nobody producing something like that. So, yeah, anyway, we had to ship that in. and started to install them, you can imagine these windows with that size, so very roughly 2 by 2 meters, so 4 square meters. Some of the units were slightly bigger. Triple pane, it has to be security glass because theoretically you could just run through. So you have to have at least 6 millimeter. In some cases it was a little bit thicker, so 8 millimeter. That's quite a little bit of weight. So this unit, for example, is about close to 400 kilograms. So you cannot really, it's not easy just to lift it or whatever. So we had to work with a crane. In some situations like this one, there's an overhang. So when you have an overhang, you cannot work with a crane anymore. It was not that easy. So to install them just generally from a technical perspective, it is easy. It's not more complicated than every other window too. But in terms of size and weight, it becomes a little tricky. So whenever you start your project, be aware of that. It makes totally sense to make the windows as big as possible to save frame, because you get more harvesting area of the glass and less, percentage-wise, less frame. The frame is the most expensive part, so you save money and you get a better performance. But it still has to be handleable, so you still have to install it on site.
Does that mean that you would have to make certain adjustments or certain limitations to your design of the house so as to allow for installation of these windows? You know, for example, the overhang would be a problem, but I imagine there would be other kind of design parameters that could cause a problem for installation. So would there be sort of a design limit imposed by the method of installation or by the nature of the materials?
So generally in a passive house, you try to get a decent amount of windows to the south, because that's the first major issue. So what you want to do is getting rule of thumb 50% of all the windows into the south, if possible. Sometimes it's just not working that way, but this is just rule of thumb what you try to achieve. Because the south is relatively easy to handle. You don't have problems with overheating, because you can have just a little bit of an overhang, whatever, that keeps you the sun out over the summertime, so no problems with overheating. In wintertime, when the sun comes in a flat angle, then you get a lot of exposure of your glass to the sun. This is design-wise the first major issue, so try to get as most as you can in the south. East and west are kind of energy neutral, so even with these really high-performance windows, you cannot harvest energy there, so you harvest as much as you lose during the nighttime or whenever. So they're neutral. The north is always a loss. So just from an energy perspective, you try to get as less windows as possible to the north. Well, then you have some issues with daylight, so you still want to have some natural daylight. So very likely you cannot go radical and have no windows in the north, but you just want to limit it to that what is necessary. So just one more. And then it's... So an overhang, if the overhang is already existing during the period when you want to install them, yeah, then you have just technically some troubles on the site. But otherwise, there are actually not really limitations. I mean, the structure has to handle the weights, but hey, that's not really a problem.
That concludes part one of a lecture on passive house by Guido Wimmers, recorded at the Sustainable Building Center in Vancouver, Canada. Find part two at Radio EcoShock, ecoshock.org. Look in the Cities page of the Audio On Demand menu.